Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your Justice for Ava of Music, News, and Criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. We're not going to play any music this week because this week we are talking about a very difficult subject and one that we think requires a tremendous amount of attention with no distraction. You may have read a few days ago a big investigative report by Joe Coscarelli and Melina Ryzik about Ryan Adams. In that piece, they interview several people who say that Adams was emotionally abusive and sexually manipulative, and at least in one case, participated in sexual communications with a minor. So on this week's podcast, we're going to talk with Joe and Melina about their story, about how it came together, and also about kind of the bigger picture issues that it brings up about how Me Too has asserted itself and also not asserted itself in the music business, and whether articles like this and stories like this are going to become more common. So I've got Joe Coscarelli, who's pop music reporter in the New York Times.
Hey, John.
Melina Ryzik, culture reporter and also part of the Pulitzer Prize winning team for our workplace sexual harassment coverage last year. Hey, Melina.
Hey there.
So, guys, there's a tremendous amount of detail in this story, but I want to talk a little bit about in the music business specifically. And I'm not talking about Ryan Adams in this case, but broadly speaking, there's a lot of whisper networks. There's a lot of people who are spoken about, stay away from so-and-so, et cetera. That's a common thing. It's much less common to have a number of people, certainly some high-profile people. You have Mandy Moore, who is Ryan's ex-wife. You've got Phoebe Bridgers. I know you spoke with other folks who are recording artists. Can you talk a little bit about how this story kind of came out from what I would imagine began as a whisper network into something more serious and substantive like this?
Yeah, I mean, this story kind of launched with, in a sort of twofold way. We got an anonymous tip. You know, we have, the Times has an anonymous tips line, and a lot of, you know, it is heavily used for information like this. People talk about, you know, check out this person, you know, he's behaved badly in whatever way. So we got one of those, and kind of, I think simultaneously, Joe was talking to some music industry sources in a way that led him to think, you know, that maybe that tip was worth looking into.
I'd been having a conversation with a source that I knew through previous stories, and this person was sort of tiptoeing around the idea that there was a prominent musician who maybe deserved looking into. Mm-hmm. And then, as Melina said, we got this tip around the same time, I think after a day or two of this sort of vague back and forth that I was having. And of course, this, like you said, the Whisper Network, this was about someone, Ryan Adams, who has a reputation. And mm-hmm. his reputation up to this point had been that of a bad boy, I think I would say, bad boy rocker, mm-hmm. you know.
A reputation he cultivated himself, I
oh,
would
yeah,
probably
definitely
say.
Definitely leaned into, famous for a sort of onstage meltdown or two, for leaving a critic a nasty voicemail,
being combative online, mm-hmm. even with fans and listeners in general,
and being somewhat of a womanizer. And that's often the euphemistic way that abusers are talked about
in public spaces.
Yep. So I think as much as he had this reputation, he was also very nimble at avoiding being pinned down on it, because he continued over the years to work with a large variety of very prominent musicians and also a lot of young women.
One of the kind of intriguing parts of the story, big picture, is this kind of forward-facing image of, I'm an advocate for young female musicians. I put them out on my label. I talk to them about songwriting. I offer mentoring. I very vocally speak out on behalf of them. And then, as you see in your piece, what's happening publicly is often quite different than what's happening behind the scenes. So maybe can we talk a little bit about some of the cognitive dissonance or the non-cognitive dissonance of those circumstances?
One thing we really wanted to underline in the piece is, and, you know, this took a few drafts to really hone in on, but the idea of how power works in the music industry, mm-hmm. and that because it is a more diffuse industry that's not as top down, sometimes an artist, even an artist who's not a household name or a bestseller, mm-hmm. or with radio hits, can wield a ton of influence and power in the industry. This is especially in something like indie rock and something mm-hmm. like alt country or whatever you want to call it, these sort of smaller scenes. Someone like Ryan Adams had a lot of cred. He had a lot of attention paid to him, and that allowed him to both lure in and champion these women. So something as simple as a tweet about how good someone's album is or an opening slot on a few of his tour dates, that brings a lot of attention to a rising or an emerging or an aspiring artist.
Right.
And that's what we saw him doing publicly. Now, what we found in our reporting is that, as we say in the piece, there was a much darker reality behind the scenes where he was sort of dangling these opportunities, telling women he would make albums with them. You know, he has a studio, he has a label, saying they were the greatest thing ever. He had a few lines that we heard over and over again. He would tell women, you know, oh, I hear your next album, it has a lot of strings on it. Or he told Phoebe Bridgers that she was like Bob Dylan. And it was always this gushing praise while simultaneously he was pursuing them sexually.
And if you're a 20-year-old artist rolling up to a studio and Ryan Adams is the most famous person you've ever met, you've got like a SoundCloud page, and suddenly someone is telling you, you know, you're the next Dylan, while also starting to send you flirty texts, it's really hard to separate those two things.
Phoebe Bridgers is one of the people in the story who, prior to your reporting, has alluded, however vaguely, seems to have alluded to some of the narratives that ended up being reported out here.
Phoebe's a really interesting case because, as you say, she has been tied to Ryan Adams in the press from the very first moment anyone heard of her. He put out a 3-song single of hers on his PacSam label in 2015, I believe.
April 2015.
Yeah. And that really shot her to prominence.
Right. Put her on the map.
It put her on the map. And since then, she's obviously released a solo album. She's released an EP as Boy Genius. She has this new album now with Conor Oberst. She's become known on her own terms. And I think as her career sort of solidified, you heard her distancing herself from Ryan more and more in public. You know, initially, everything was the Ryan Adams approved singer-songwriter, right, Phoebe Bridgers. And again, that's how this system of patronage and influence works.
Right. And the cheap shorthand of the internet doesn't help with circumstances like that,
of
when
course
people are just looking for a quick descriptor to squeeze into 140
course
characters.
And then increasingly in interviews and on stage, she would talk about him and she would say, this song is about a guy who was an asshole to me, essentially.
Yep.
And, you know, spoke about him in interviews. Similarly, we actually heard a tale from her of, and I think this is another good example of how power works in the music industry. When she first started speaking out against him in interviews, one was printed and whoever from Ryan's team made a back channel call to that website and basically had her comments about him removed from the internet. So these are the sorts of things that happened, but she didn't take that as a silencing tactic. I think ultimately she kept going, and, you know, she ultimately spoke with us. And I think it took her many years to sort of fully grasp the level of abuse and manipulation that he had put her through. And you sort of saw her working through it in real time.
I think that's a hallmark of doing this kind of reporting, is a lot of times people don't realize what kind of impact this had on them personally and professionally until they really start to talk about it a lot. A lot of times, you know, in several cases for this story, some of the stories we heard, people had not really talked about it much. And
definitely not processed it.
Yeah, absolutely. So it takes some distance and even just the verbalizing of it to make them realize what actually happened. And then they start to take stock.
One thing that is towards the end of your story, and this is in the Mandy Moore section, her sense that the thing that was happening to her was so specific in a weird way to her, or so particular to her marriage or her relationship with Ryan, both musical, personal, romantic, etc., that it couldn't possibly be a thing that had been replicated in other circumstances, which I think speaks to what you're saying. I mean, this is a person who not only was working with Ryan, but also married him and walled off whatever treatment she was receiving in that relationship and thinking that it was particular to her, when in fact it didn't seem like it was.
Yeah, I think just to close the loop on what happened with Phoebe Bridgers, her relationship with Ryan was actually quite compressed. It happened over the span of only a few weeks, but she basically records this music with him. He says he's going to put it out on his label. He says he's going to take her on tour. And then they begin a romantic relationship, a consensual romantic relationship. Mm-hmm. He's about 40 years old at the time. She's 20. You know, she told us, I'd only ever had a high school boyfriend. I was feeling like, oh my God, I'm about to have a real adult interaction. Like, she was caught up. And then immediately, once she enters this relationship with him, he becomes harassing and emotionally abusive to
controlling,
her, controlling,
yeah.
sending her all these text messages.
Barraging her, right.
You know, she said one time she went to the movies with her mother and that...
She turned her phone off.
Right. And she came out to, you know, dozens of messages where he says, oh, you don't love me anymore. I'm gonna kill myself.
If you don't respond, what's going on?
And
where are you?
We should note here that Ryan Adams has denied almost all of this via his lawyers. After the release of the story, he tweeted a statement in which he apologized generally to anybody he may have hurt, however unintentionally. He insisted that he had never communicated with anyone underage knowingly.
Sexually, for sexual purposes.
Right. And he said, period. And that was his response. His lawyer had a much more vociferous response to the New York Times, basically saying he didn't remember any of these relationships going as the women described them. He denied basically everything that we've discussed thus far and basically everything we will discuss moving forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Including things that you guys have reviewed documentation of.
Yeah. So a lot of this reporting included looking at text messages, emails, direct messages.
We have loads of correspondence between him and all of the sources in the story.
Sure.
That he somehow does not remember.
Right. So the final piece of Phoebe's story is that when she then breaks off her relationship with him, he sort of starts to pull back on his promises, right? He says, actually, you're not coming on this tour with me. You know, we'll see about this music we recorded together. Eventually it did come out. But we saw this mirrored time and time again in women we spoke to. And what you said about the isolation and how Mandy Moore said she felt like nobody else could have possibly experienced what she did. I think we see this a lot in these alleged abuse cases. According to these women, Ryan was very adept at keeping them apart from each other. You know, he told Phoebe, Mandy's crazy.
Because he was having the relationship with Phoebe while he was still married to Mandy. And he had a number of these relationships. His entire online correspondence with the underage fan happened while he was married to Mandy. And so the women had no idea. Mandy had no idea about the extent of his behavior or his unfaithfulness, basically until we effectively started doing this reporting.
Sure. And the story ultimately is not about his unfaithfulness,
right.
but it's about the way he sort of wielded his power
and manipulated
people and did this sort of bait and switch where he would pretend to or actively be involved in someone's career. And then if they spurned him, pull back and become vengeful and harassing and emotionally abusive.
And to sort of circle back to kind of how power works in the music business, as you say before, power is diffuse, and it's also, it's like various tributaries, right? There's like so many different ways that one could potentially emerge from relative obscurity into some kind of renown. And what you see in this piece time and again is people who thought they found their tributary. They thought they found it. And then as soon as it was clear that that one was poisoned because of all these other things, walked away. Obviously, Phoebe Bridgers is a case of someone who persevered and pushed through and chose another path, but not everybody did. To me, one of the true sad takeaways of this piece is all the music and all the people whose dreams were squelched, all the music that didn't get made as a result of this.
And I think that's also been a recurring theme in all of this Me Too reporting and you know, women telling their stories. It's about the careers that never were, in the Weinstein case and the Louis case, over and over again, people whose dreams were squashed. And as you said, Phoebe Bridgers, not a great example of that because she was sort of simultaneously, as she was meeting Ryan, her career was taking off and she sort of put her head down and was like, I'm not going to let this guy stop me. Her mother, who we spoke to for this story, said when he said, actually, you're not coming on this tour of Europe with me, which would have been her first tour, she said,
her first trip to Europe, she was getting a passport for this travel.
And her first ever tour. And, you know, her mother said that Phoebe said to her, F it, like, I'll get to Europe on my own. So that's one end, but we also heard some heartbreaking stories of people who that didn't happen for and who, you know, Ryan is forever sort of linked to their relationship with music. And that goes for someone even as successful as Mandy Moore, who has since found a career as an actress.
You open the piece with a story about a person who's not famous, a person who's not known, a young woman who you guys are referring to as Ava. Ava is her middle name. And she is someone who was a Ryan Adams fan. They communicated on social media and on text. And from your reporting, it seems that those messages turned sexually explicit. And she was 15 and 16 when those messages were exchanged. First of all, how does Ryan Adams end up texting with a teenager, number one? And then number two, what were the sort of steps in that process that led to this thing.
She was a fan. You know, she followed him on Twitter. He followed her back. And when she noticed that, she sent him a DM excitedly, you know, to say hi. And she said he replied right away. And they started having a conversation. We've seen some of those early DMs. And they start talking right away about music. And he's asking her about what does she play? What's her style? They start talking about instruments. Like, it's a very musically oriented conversation. So obviously she's excited. I mean, she's 14 years old when they start talking. She is a bass player and successful in the sense that she's like gigging. She's got shows. She travels to New York with her family and plays at clubs.
A bit of like a prodigy in the scene at the time.
And definitely feels like, you know, this is it. This is music is her passion. It's what got her through difficult times in her life. The year before she started talking to Ryan, her father died. And it's what got her through that experience. I mean, this was it for her. And she was homeschooled. She was sort of isolated at home. And she started having this communication with someone who represented, you know, the creative future that she clearly envisioned for herself.
Yeah, it was aspiring to.
Yeah. And, you know, he very early on was encouraging of her musical pursuit, started saying we should start a band. Eventually he suggested to her that he would produce music if she started a band with another teenager. So it seemed like he was supportive of her as an artist before anything sexual happened.
And at what point did it turn, and in what ways did it turn?
They talked a lot. You know, we reviewed 3,217 text messages that they exchanged in a 9-month period when she was 15 and 16.
And we saw a lot of communication outside of that as well between them.
So they talked a lot, and those conversations, you know, about music turned into sexual conversations that sometimes involved explicit photos. But one thing that was a through line through all of their communication, really even starting from their first messages, was him worried about her age and repeatedly asking her, how old are you?
And he mentions R. Kelly in one context.
Yeah. Later, as things get sexual, he gets really quite anxious about it. The other thing that's a big through line is that he asks to keep the conversations a secret.
He says, you know, your mom's going to kill me if she finds out about this. I've never talked to anybody as young as you. You know, there were times in these conversations when he said, you're 18. Show me you're 18. Tell me you're 18. You have to convince me. He said, I'm having a panic attack. And there were times when she said, yes, I am. Or
she told him she was older than she was.
Yes, and I will read part of his lawyer's statement on this matter just to have that clear. It says, Mr. Adams unequivocally denies that he ever engaged in inappropriate online sexual communications with someone he knew was underage. He is disgusted and repulsed by the notion of allegedly having any sort of inappropriate sexual contact online with someone underage. He does not condone or support such behavior, and frankly, the accusation makes him sick.
But you guys have viewed the communications.
Sure. And at the same time, the lawyer also told us that he did not recall these conversations. And in fact, while he has talked to aspiring musicians and fans online, he does not recall ever having spoke with anyone about anything other than music. And that's a quote from the lawyer.
While he denied that he would have ever knowingly communicated with someone who was underage in a sexual manner, and said he did not recall any of these 3,217 messages that we have seen, he also said, well, he did somehow recall enough about her to think she looked older than she was. And actually, the lawyer letter included several photos of her where they said,
though we did not provide them her name.
Correct. They said, well, she looks to be 20.
Yeah, that was something, one of the things I was most curious about in the piece was that I can't imagine you provided the name of the person.
No, we did not.
Right, and that they came back to you with photos of that person, obviously knowing full well who it was.
Right, so that's
despite the fact that he said he did not recall any of these conversations. So people can draw their own conclusions about how they're framing that.
Yeah, I will say, you know, the height of their sexual correspondence that we saw as detailed in the piece was around November of 2014, right? So she had just turned 16 years old. He had just turned 40 years old. And that's when there are these texts that we quote. And at one point he asks her, he says, do me a paranoid favor, show me your ID. This is in the midst of a sort of sexting relationship. They would also speak on Skype. We viewed screenshots of Ryan exposing himself to her on Skype. At a certain point in that conversation, she says, do you really want to see my ID? And he responds, only if it's done in the hottest way
possible.
LOL. So that led us to believe that potentially whether or not he knew how old she was, he maybe didn't really want to know the answer. And, you know, we spoke to legal experts about this. State laws are different than federal laws. Digital communication, sexting, child porn, that stuff is different than age of consent.
Which is about physical interaction. Right. And they never actually met in person.
They never met in person. It's complicated. We have reported that the FBI, in the aftermath of our story, is looking into this case and is hoping to get in touch with this young woman. Her family is still deciding whether or not they want to communicate and go down that road. But that's the evidence that we have and that we've seen.
Ryan told her repeatedly that he was following her career, and we could tell in the text that he watched videos of her performing. Now, if you Googled her at that time, most of the content about her online would say, like, check out this 15-year-old bassist. You know what I mean? So if you had any kind of cursory Google search of this person, there were pointers that suggested that she was definitely not 18.
Though we don't know if her birth date was online or anything like that.
Right. It's just, it's true. You know.
At any point in their communication, does she explicitly say, I am this age, the age she actually is or was?
Not in the communications we reviewed. But there was a lot of talk about, you know, her living at home with her mom.
Right.
Things like that that would suggest not an adult.
The final kind of insult in the Ava section of your piece is she never played a gig again. I mean, here's a person who chose this path or thought she had found an entree into the industry that was so meaningful and to make music that was meaningful to her, and this entire experience has basically turned her completely in the opposite direction and sent her away.
Yeah. I mean, she's hardly picked up her bass since, you know, she really was deeply affected by this. And, you know, I mean, she's still so young. She's only 20. And I think she's still sort of working out what she might do and become as she grows up. But it is really heartbreaking. And again, like, she was a big songwriter before, all that kind of stuff. And to think that that might have been turned off by this experience is really, really sad, but also unfortunately incredibly common in this kind of reporting to hear that.
Yeah, I think she told us specifically that as her relationship with Ryan sort of developed and she realized that he wasn't actually interested in what she had to say, but that it was just sexual power for him, that the idea that she would be objectified or have to sleep with people to get ahead in the music industry, that that's what this business was like, it sort of poisoned the whole well for her, and she just stepped away.
What's interesting is so many of the things that came up with Ava, who is a teenager, who is not famous, who is not a recording artist in the traditional sense, also come up in your story with Mandy Moore. Mandy Moore, who had been a successful recording artist prior to meeting Ryan Adams, obviously was evolving her sound, but who had an established career before meeting Ryan Adams. So many of the things that Mandy said about her relationship to music in your story really mirrored what Ava said, and it shows you how this kind of insidious behavior can affect anyone at any point in their life. That was incredibly difficult to swallow.
She is somebody who had, you know, her own sort of stature, but I think it shows how poisonous this kind of behavior is, this manipulation and control type of behavior, especially when practiced by someone as expert as Ryan appears to be, as somebody who has spent years doing this over and over to women. She said that he, at first, you know, he volunteered to work on her record. Of course, their initial connection was musical. Basically, they met when they were both on tour. She was 23. He's a decade older. She was drawn to him as this sort of authentic artistic voice, which is she was exiting her teen pop years and trying to reestablish herself in a different way. And he said, I'm going to be here to help you with that. He volunteered to work on her record. You know, he emailed her managers and stuff like that. And he was getting his studio and label up and running. So it became, yeah, of course, Ryan will do this. And then when she parted ways with her music manager, he basically was in control of her music career because he kept saying, I will do this for you. And he had very detailed visions that he would share with her. You know, here's the album art. Here's the track listing. He would, as late as 2014, you know, 4 years after he initially promised that he would record this record, he was still sending that kind of stuff around and, of course, never actually recorded her, although they did write songs together. And he promised he would sometimes book studio time for them and then just replace her with another woman.
I think it's important to note here, like another thing echoed in all of our reporting is just how strong he would come on initially and how charming he was, frankly. Right. You know, that's a word we heard over and over again, that nobody had ever met anyone like him. He could really light up a room and he's this sort of master communicator that leaves you spinning in good ways and in bad ways. And he would really come in and sweep these women off of their feet, to hear them tell it, both with musical promises and compliments and gifts and
attention.
And attention. And this, again, sort of mirrors even his most recent fiance, who is a source in the piece, Megan Butterworth. They're no longer together. She also said that she experienced psychological abuse with him, physical intimidation, breaking things. He did the same thing to her. She said, you know, I thought he was intensely devoted to me, and then it turned into something else.
Torment. Yeah. I mean, as Mandy put it, people think of him as this exquisite songwriter, and he basically uses that same skill set to be as biting and as cruel. So while he was making all those promises to her and stringing her along for years about making the record, he was also sort of demeaning her talent and telling her, well, you're not a real artist because you don't play an instrument. And sort of she would say, like, well, what about Stevie Nicks or whatever, you know, but he just kind of kept on that. And that's something that eventually really got into her skin, especially when it comes from somebody that's supposed to love you and support you. And it undermined her confidence as an artist. And that is something that I know is really hard to shake for people. She had released 6 albums. The 6th one came right after she married Ryan, and nothing since.
You guys have spoken with several people who Adams had professional relationships with. In the few days that have passed since the piece came out, you've started to see other people who've worked with him, maybe not go into detail, but sort of allude to potential similar issues in their professional interactions with him, or perhaps extra professional. You saw Liz Phair allude to something on Twitter. You saw Karen Elson. Can you talk a little bit about kind of what's been shaken loose in these few days?
A lot.
Yeah, I mean, we had a feeling there was more to this. You know, we talked to many people who are not in the story. There is a section in the story where we say that there are 2 other singer-songwriters we spoke with who requested anonymity because they didn't want to invite any sort of retaliation, but they said they experienced the exact same pattern, you know, intense flattery, promises, and then a turn and a jerking away of those promises. So I think we knew that this may have happened over and over again. Again, Ryan Adams has denied that he has the power to make or break careers. He says he doesn't do this, basically. But we've gotten messages in private from people. You know, a lot of people are posting to their own social media saying they've had these experiences with him, you know, dating back to the early 2000s,
yeah,
more than a decade. There's no end to this sort of behavior in the music industry, whether it's Ryan Adams or broader. You know, we've had a lot of people sort of mansplaining the idea of groupies to us in the last few days.
Yeah, and it's been really like, striking that that's like still a take that people want to deliver like, in public.
Yeah,
in
I mean,
2019.
A, we know some rock history. B, that's not what this is. And C, just because it's always existed doesn't mean it needs to exist any further.
Right.
You know, this idea of,
and I think that's one of the reasons this story seems to have resonated as much as it has, is because, you know, as we talked about in the beginning, like this behavior is pervasive and it has been a part of the music industry and probably every creative industry almost since the beginning. And what's different now is that women are saying, not anymore.
Right.
I'm going to shout this out. I'm going to talk about it because it can't happen anymore and people can't abuse their power and abuse the dynamic in these male dominated industries like this.
I think another dynamic that makes this story a little bit unique but echoes some of the things we've seen in other smaller Me Too stories in the music industry is that Ryan Adams is a real internet person. He's been masterful at using the internet throughout his career. He has a very fervent fan community online that he's known to interact with. Had a bunch of MySpace pages. He was big on Tumblr. He was a blogger. He's very well known on Twitter and on Instagram. And he used these channels to find women, to shout out women, to sort of reach out to them, as we saw in the case of Ava and as we've seen in other cases. But then he could also wield that power in more destructive ways. You know, Megan Butterworth, again, his most recent fiance, there's a publicly available Instagram post that he made after they broke up in which, you know, it's a photo of her and he's tagging a family member of hers and saying vile things about her. And his fans were up on this. He's just been known for many years to be able to maneuver on the internet. And that breaking down of the walls between artists and their fans has been a big part of this. I think when I first got to the Times, I wrote a story about a Warped Tour artist called Front Porch Step.
Yeah.
And he had these sort of online-only interactions with underage fans. Jesse Lacey of Brand New has been alleged to get into these sorts of exchanges and psychologically torment some fans, allegedly. And, you know, he's apologized for that. I think, you know, that's something you see a lot more in the 21st century that is, it's thorny.
There have been other real world consequences that have come up for Adams since the story has come out. You guys want to talk us through a little bit?
He announced earlier this year that he was planning to release 3 albums. And the first of those albums, the one that had the most concrete release date, which was in April, Big Colors, has now been dropped from the schedule.
Has he been dropped from the label yet or no?
The label has not said anything thus far. So Ryan Adams has a label called PacSam. His albums this year were scheduled to be released through PacSam in partnership with Blue Note Records. Blue Note is a subsidiary of Capitol Music Group, which is a subsidiary of Universal Music Group, which is sort of the biggest music conglomerate in the world. Now, those people, they don't own the music. They don't own Ryan's music as far as my reporting goes, but they distribute it. That's a common arrangement for people who have small labels. They have distribution deals with big companies. So this is just another sort of channel of power that Ryan had access to. We learned from retailers, from record stores, basically, that they were told by Universal that this album wasn't coming. The label has yet to say anything. Also important to note, Ryan was managed up until mid-2018, we believe, by a guy named John Silva, who is, you know, not a public figure, but a huge figure behind the scenes in rock music.
Huge source of power, absolutely.
You know, manages the Foo Fighters, Beck, you know,
Saint
worked
Vincent.
With St. Vincent, right. Does the Nirvana legacy. Like, this is, and this is someone who we don't have any statement from him
he
on the record.
He declined to comment, right.
He declined to comment, but this was the sort of team that Ryan was rolling around with for many years, and they did split at some point. We don't know the terms of that split. That has not been made public to us, but there have been people distancing themselves from him over the years for whatever reasons. Ryan's current manager, as far as we know, is someone who started working with him about 8 months ago. Her name is Ty Stiglorious. She's best known as John Legend's manager and a sort of figure in the Time's Up movement for the music industry. She has a pretty storied career, one of the only powerful female managers, and someone who has made their career about social justice and criminal justice reform and all the things that John Legend is known for. She has not said anything on the record as far as we know, so we don't really know the state of that relationship. Ryan has a lot of other big collaborators. His albums this year were supposed to feature
a lot of guests.
Yeah, a lot of guests. John Mayer, Emmylou Harris. You know, he did some production on the new Jenny Lewis album, which was coming out. Jenny Lewis released a statement last night that said, "I'm deeply troubled by Ryan Adams' alleged behavior. Although he and I had a working professional relationship, I stand in solidarity with the women who have come forward."
Jason Isbell also said publicly on Twitter that he believes the stories of these women.
Yeah, Jason Isbell, who is also featured on Ryan's new music that may or may not ever come out, but he was asked if he knew about this behavior. He said no, but then in a follow-up was asked if he believed it, and he said yep.
So with pieces of this nature, there's so much that we see in the story, and there's also a tremendous amount that we don't see, and that includes, I'm sure, any number of details that didn't make it into the piece, and also all the sort of shoe leather reporting. Can you talk about what it's like to gather sources in these kinds of spaces that are maybe a little bit less regulated and looser? Talk about process.
Yeah, well, we've been working on this story for almost 5 months. They're obviously very involved reporting process. And what's different about this from almost any other, you know, writing that we do is that you have a very close back and forth connection with the sources. The first conversations that we have are typically what we call on background, which means that it wouldn't, you know, we wouldn't necessarily go and write anything from those conversations. That's not how these stories work anyway, because they take such a long time to do. But it's a way for us to gather information and make sure that everybody is comfortable and understand what this process is like. Because frankly, what this process is these women going through what is often the worst or most traumatizing period of their life over and over and over again as we get all the details, as we make sure everything is accurate. I couldn't even begin to tell you how many conversations we had with some of these sources. They're like daily, multiple times a day conversations.
And then we're verifying them,
yeah,
not only with hard documentation, evidence, text messages, emails, etc. But we do a lot of corroboration, what we call corroboration, which is speaking to people who were around at the time, who may have witnessed some of these interactions, who may have known about them simultaneously, who may have been told.
Friends and family members. So not only is it uncomfortable and unpleasant often conversations with the source, but then you have to call up their mom, their dad, their best friend, somebody that was in the studio and say, do you remember witnessing this? It's not, obviously not easy reporting. And, you know, when people talk about the strength or bravery of these women, that's to me what comes to mind. Not only, of course, do they then have to face the fact of their worst potentially moments of their life being made public, but they have to relive them throughout the reporting process. And it can be
really, has to hold up to scrutiny.
Right. It's very difficult. It can be triggering for a lot of people.
And this is something you guys have both done previously. You've worked on the Russell Simmons story, Louis C.K. Are you seeing the same things pop up and the same tropes pop up across the stories that you guys have worked on?
I think so.
Yeah, one of the really important things we try to do is to not tell a story of an isolated incident, but to describe a pattern of behavior, that these stories are, it's not gossip, it's not meant to be salacious, it's meant to expose an MO, basically, when power is abused systematically over and over again. So what we try to do as we gather all of these women's stories is find the overlap. And you know, a source we haven't mentioned so far, for instance, Courtney J., another songwriter who, she had basically a very sped up version of this. You know, Ryan reached out to her on Twitter. He told her she was like Linda Ronstadt. He said, let's come over and let's make some music. And she thinks she's not signed. She's worked but not been super successful. And she thinks like, here it is, my big moment. And then she gets there and it turns sexual right away. And, you know, she says she sort of shuts herself off and is resigned to these advances from this powerful musician, and that stuck with her, you know, and that hurt her music career.
And what struck her actually specifically was that the smoothness of the way that he approached her, she felt like this is not the only time he must have done this.
Right.
You know,
it seemed practiced to her.
And this is another instance that he's denied. He said he never had a writing session with Courtney J where they ended up in bed. That was another denial from his team. But those are the patterns of behavior that
we look for. And that's not to say that an isolated instance of bad behavior or sexual harassment is not troubling. It is. But when we're doing this kind of story, when we're putting this reporting muscle behind it, we really want to make sure that what we're talking about is this systemic abuse of power. I mean, one of the reasons that we do these stories is to shine a light on that.
Right. These are stories about individuals, but these are really stories about enterprises and systems and how, in our case, the music business works or in this case, fails to work.
For women.
Yeah, for women.
And therefore, why we don't see women at the top of the field, you know, behind the scenes, on stage, whatever, you know, you can find the numbers. The USC Annenberg study is out there about how many women creators there are in music. And when people say, why aren't there women on this festival bill? Why aren't there women in the boardrooms? This is why.
This is one of the reasons, yeah.
Do you get the sense from your reporting and from the conversations that have popped up kind of in response to your reporting that there's any broader industry efforts or efforts by powerful individuals to try to remove these obstacles, to try to normalize studio relationships, to kind of basically take away the opportunity to sexualize these professional interactions? Is that a conversation that's happening at all?
I don't know. I think it's really hard to undo, you know, decades or centuries of these systems. I think it's also important to note you haven't seen a lot of musicians go quote-unquote down in Me Too reporting,
right,
especially active musicians. You know, you have the sort of R. Kelly's of the world. You mentioned Russell Simmons, who is more of an executive. You know, you have Charlie Watt, L.A. Reid, again, label people who have lost jobs over alleged sexual harassment. But you don't really see people pulling the curtain back on people who continue to wield power and who are forward-facing. Not a lot of household names, despite, as we've mentioned, these whisper networks. So as far as how it's being fixed, I think a lot of it is strong young women who are banding together and doing it themselves and saying, well, we don't need these traditional gatekeepers. As far as making the gatekeepers behave, I don't know.
Well, one thing I think we heard over and over from our sources is the reason they wanted to come forward, the reason that they wanted to go through what ultimately can be a very traumatic process and difficult process is because they wanted to protect other women from ever having to deal with this behavior. And they said, you know, if I had known, if anybody had talked about this, I would never have gotten into a room with him. I would never have gotten into a relationship with him. And so they wanted to protect women and they wanted to move forward themselves. You know, I know Mandy wants to, she misses music and she wants to get back to it. And she feels like Ryan should not be able to stop her anymore.
You've spoken throughout the conversation about some of the denials that Ryan's lawyer has given you guys about some specific things that are in your story. Is there anything that's come from Ryan specifically?
There was his statement after publication on Twitter. I believe that's the last public use of social media that we've seen. People have criticized it on apology terms. Mm-hmm. Is this the apology needed? But it was, for whatever was wrong with it, that's for other people to decide. But it was quite a turn from how he tweeted at us in anticipation of the story being released. Obviously, we had gone to him and told him that this was coming and given him the chance to respond. And he tweeted at the New York Times basically saying, I know you got lawyers, but do you have the truth on your side? No, I do. You've run out of friends. Run your smear piece. The legal eagles see you. Rats. I'm effing taking you down. That sort of thing. So
he deleted it, or someone deleted that message.
It was deleted.
It was deleted.
And then, yeah. And then we've seen a slightly more contrite public statement, but we don't know where it goes from here.
Before we go this week, I guess the thing that I kept thinking reading your story is just how important it is if you see behavior like this, if you're privy to behavior like this, if you're in the studio with someone who's behaving like this, if your bandmate or coworker or producer or whoever is behaving like this, how important it is to speak up and to speak up, whether it's publicly or privately, to that person and say these are not ways that you should behave. And I'm really grateful in this case that so many people were willing to speak with you guys about this particular circumstance, and I can only hope that it leads to more. That's our show. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com. We're always here and we're always listening. Subscribe to the podcast anywhere you get your audio content. Thanks to my guests this week, Melina Rizek and Joe Coscarelli. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Met Stepper Media. We'll be back next week.